couple of days ago, my husband and I walked to the Covington Riverfront, or as close as we could get to it. Riverside Drive was completely covered in river water, and a stop sign was nearly submerged. Nearly a century ago, just one county over, a Kentucky artist named Harlan Hubbard witnessed a flood that changed his life. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. An exhibit exploring the work and philosophy of Harlan Hubbard is coming to the Barringer Crawford Museum in Covington. The exhibit is inspired by Jessica Whitehead's biography called Driftwood, The Life of Harlan Hubbard. Jessica Whitehead joins me now to talk about Harlan Hubbard and his enduring legacy. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you so much, Lucy. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. So flooding is devastating so many communities throughout Kentucky right now. Talk about the impact a flood in the 1930s had on Harlan Hubbard and how it changed the course of his life.
Absolutely. Well, of course, the 1930s are infamous to people who were living in the Ohio River Valley at that time because of the massive flooding that happened, especially in 1936, 1937. And the flood of 1937, they call it a thousand-year flood, something that really devastated so many communities all along our section here, in particular between Louisville and Cincinnati. And Harlan Hubbard had a painting studio right along the river road there beneath Fort Thomas. And he got a front row seat pretty much to the devastation of that 1937 flood. And he was very used to the idea of flooding as something that was part of the rhythm of life in living around Cincinnati.
Well, and he wrote about the impact watching those floods had on him, didn't he?
He did, and he's wonderfully articulate in his journals, and he has a beautiful quote that I absolutely love from the 1930s where he says, "I have been affected by this rise of water. It suggested primeval times when the earth was being made. It separated the earth from the works of man. I saw my true dwelling place. I need a flood in my soul to carry off all the old drift and flimsy habits that have extended down to the water's edge. It will come causing suffering and loss. If it does not come, the river will become stagnant, filled with growth and mud." And this statement that he's made in his journal about flooding, it's something that recurs in all kinds of different ways throughout his writing. The impact of floods and, of course, the impact of what floods bring into communities, in particular, driftwood.
Yeah. You mentioned that 1937 flood, that thousand-year flood. At that point, obviously, he was a poetic soul and a talented writer. He was also kind of a frustrated artist, as I understand it. Tell us about his work as an artist and how you first became inspired by Harlan Hubbard.
Yeah, for sure. So the Harlan Hubbard that we meet at the beginning of the 1930s and into the 1930s is perhaps not the Harlan Hubbard that if you've read his books before or seen his artwork before, that you would recognize. He's very dissatisfied. And part of that came from this long multi-decade exploration of who he was as an artist and not really finding the kinds of support or interest in his types of painting while he was trying to establish this career. He was a trained artist, but he really wasn't getting the foothold that he wanted within the arts community. But of course, he was very very prolific artist, and his paintings in watercolor, in oil, in acrylic are all over this region in different archives and museums. Where I first discovered Harlan Hubbard's artwork was while I was a student at Hanover College near Madison, Indiana, that has a wonderful collection of Hubbard paintings, including one that really entranced me that hung behind the library circulation desk there at the Duggan Library at Hanover. And I was an art history major, and I saw these paintings, and I was enraptured by this incredible artist who actually would settle in the 1950s, just a little bit downstream from where Hanover College was. So it was a special place for him and a special place for me.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned where he settled, but before that, he met the woman he would marry in the 19, was it late 30s, early 40s? How did he and his wife Anna meet, and what do you think drew them to each other?
Oh gosh, it's a wonderful story and one that's special to Cincinnati. His wife, a woman named Anna Eichenhout, she was a librarian in the Fine Arts Library there in Cincinnati. In the late 1930s, Harlan Hubbard was coming into the library all the time over in Cincinnati to do research for his paintings, to do research for his writing. He was an avid reader and musician, and so he was checking out all kinds of books about music and art and poetry. And both of them sort of bonded rather politely at first over these shared interests in music, in art, in history. But when Anna, who was a trained pianist, found out that Harlan played the violin, she suggested they play some music together. And that started a wonderful courtship and then later marriage that came to them pretty late in both of their lives. Both of them were in their 40s when they married each other.
I love that Anna made the first move. I think that's fantastic.
She sure did. Yeah, some people describe her as sort of retiring, but she actually was pretty sure what she wanted when it came to her relationship with Harlan.
Yeah, I'm with her. I asked my husband on our first date too, so I'm on
I love
Team Anna. We're
it.
talking about the life and work of artist and author Harlan Hubbard. Talk a bit about their relationship, how they lived, where they lived. I mean, the river played a huge role in their lives, didn't it?
Yeah, so the first half of both of their lives was fairly conventional in many ways. Harlan was caring for his mother, and he lived with her until she died in 1943. Anna was as I said, a librarian. She was teaching music, but once they became married, both of them sort of catalyzed this incredible adventurous spirit in each other. And so, as soon as they were married in April of 1943, and once they were no longer caring for Harlan's mother, who passed away later that year, they got to explore some really incredible dreams that they had for how they wanted to live differently in a completely non-traditional way. Their expression of that first came by moving down to the riverbank below Fort Thomas at a place formerly called Brent, and building themselves a shanty boat there at the river community, where there was already a little shanty boat community there. But building themselves a shanty boat and intending to live on that shanty boat and drifting down the Ohio and Mississippi rivers all the way to the Gulf. Just an incredible adventure that certainly, both of them had a pretty significant learning curve on trying to learn the ways of shanty boating, learn the ways of navigating on these rivers, and certainly learning important lessons about self-sufficiency and living much in little.
How long did that take?
Yeah, so they lived at Brent for 2 years, tied up at Brent on their shanty boat, but then they ultimately, in 1947, decided that they were going to start their drifting journey. And times like right now, when we're experiencing high water on the Ohio River, were perfect for boats like Harlan and Anna's. Harlan and Anna had no motor on this boat, so they depended upon the natural current of the river to take them to their next destination. So they would spend their winters and early springs drifting to a new location, and then when the water level began to go down as the temperatures rose and the seasons changed, they would find a little nook somewhere where they really loved the people or they loved the landscape. They would tie up, plant a garden, and spend their summer and fall there cultivating this garden and creating the supplies and rations that then would sustain them through their next drifting season. And they did this all the way until 1951, 1952. So it was an incredible experience to celebrate their ninth wedding anniversary at the end of this incredible journey that had been a multi-year and certainly multi-location experience.
Wow. Well, and you mentioned that they settled, was it in Trimble County that they built their home where they eventually settled?
Yeah, they did. So Trimble County, they settled in an area that is technically in the postal district of Milton, Kentucky, which is right across from Madison, Indiana. They're a couple miles down from the city center of Milton, but they settled at the place where they spent their first shantyboat summer, actually. And this was a little place that they had discovered that they just fell in love with called Payne's Landing, that they would later call Payne Hollow. And when they were looking for a place to put down roots after their grand shantyboat adventure, Harlan and Anna kept thinking about Payne Hollow and how much they loved the community there, how much they loved the river there, and how perfect that place was to create this sort of shanty boat experience on land of living, continuing to live in self-sufficiency, continuing to live off the grid in this very unusual back to the land kind of life before the back to the land movement of the 1970s was really gaining traction.
Yeah, we do have a caller on the line. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. What would you like to share with us today?
First of all, what a great guest. And I already have my tickets for the Carnegie for her lecture, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. I just had a comment because I'm a huge Harlan Hubbard fan. And one of the things that to me is so great about Harlan Hubbard is when you read his journals, if you've ever camped in the wintertime, you know, it's very difficult to camp in the wintertime. But can you imagine being on a shanty boat in the Ohio River in the wintertime? But yet, when you read his journals, it's all peace and joy, the way he looks at the world. And it really makes you reflect on the way you look at things, because I'm sure there were tremendous physical hardships involved in that. But that's not what he talks about. What he talks about is the peace and joy and the beauty that him and his wife are experiencing on the river.
Oh.
And I think it's just truly a Kentucky gem.
Well, thank you, John. That's what a wonderful sentiment to share with us. Did you find that in his journals, Jessica?
Absolutely. I think what John's bringing up is an incredibly important point to make. Harlan and Anna, but Harlan in his writing specifically, was very attuned to the specific and unique beauty of each season. And each season brought with it great joy, absolutely great joy. He loved to paint winter landscapes. That was something he loved to do. A lot of people sort of shy away and they want to just see, you know, big green landscapes, big green hills and trees. But Harlan was very adept at creating those beautiful river and landscapes in his painting that express that very recognizable sort of quality of the air, of the water. You can sort of feel the chill and even picture the light of a Kentucky winter. So winter, certainly in his writing and in his art, was something that brought him great inspiration and great joy.
Thank you for that call, John. We sure appreciate it. So, Jessica, you know, you talked a little bit about Payne Hollow, where the Hubbards built this home and they were kind of living, I guess these days we'd call it living off the grid, but that didn't mean they gave up life's pleasures. Talk about how they got a piano into that place they built.
Yeah, so that's a favorite story to tell. So I mentioned that both of them really loved music. They were both accomplished musicians, and certainly a requirement of wherever they were living together was to be able to have instruments to play with one another. And on the shanty boat, of course, a piano was not practical. So Anna brought, so Anna actually learned to play and brought a cello with her on the shanty boat. And so she and Harlan were able to still play together during that adventure. But by the time they got to Payne Hollow and settled there, built their first cabin there, Anna was really missing her piano. And so she had had an upright piano that she kept when they were first married that had come from her apartment when she was still living in Cincinnati. And so they hitched that onto a trailer and hauled it into that hollow all the way down about a mile long trail into this hollow and installed that in the home. But that was only the first piano that went down into Payne Hollow. There were actually two that went down there. And the one most people recognize and remember from visiting the Hubbards at Payne Hollow is a baby grand Steinway that Anna had inherited from her mother when she passed away, that they picked up at her mother's home in Grand Rapids, Michigan, drove all the way to Kentucky, and then again, hitched up a trailer to a tractor and hauled it down into Payne Hollow. And of course, the result was perfectly fulfilling for all that labor, because they were able to fill this wonderful, beautiful, bespoke, hand-built home that they created there in Payne Hollow with wonderful music. And that was part of the magic of Payne Hollow.
When you think about the way Harlan and Anna Hubbard lived, do you think of it as them renouncing the modern world or embracing the natural world? Is it neither? Is it both?
I think it's definitely both. Definitely both. For Harlan, one of the reasons he was so dissatisfied before he met Anna is because he felt like he was too trammeled to the commercial world, to the what he called the world of man, the world of people, and he didn't want to be part of this system that was, in his mind, really. Focusing on the wrong things in life. What he loved was beauty. He loved art. He was a true, humanities person. He loved these things that were beautiful and good and kind, that in many ways the modern world was degrading in his eyes. For Anna, I don't know that it was as much of a concern in terms of, any sort of statement like that. I think Anna was someone who took incredible pride in doing the kinds of creative work she had to do to make their lives at Payne Hollow happen. So, they grew almost all of their own food. Anna had to adapt cooking skills that she had from her life before into these incredible menus that were incorporating, for example, groundhog or American groundnuts or, things that they had foraged and things that they had grown or things that they were had been able to trap and kill. Not a menu that most of us are trained to be able to create. Harlan and Anna had to, do laundry without the conveniences of any sort of contraptions, no electricity at Payne Hollow, and no traditional running water at Payne Hollow. So laundry day was truly a laundry day, maybe several days to do these things that, even though they sound arduous or difficult to those of us who do live with those conveniences, Anna and Harlan took great pride in the joy of hard work and the joy of the art of living, and that everything that you do, whether it's laundry or painting, everything that you do can be infused with beauty and goodness and can be responsible to the earth around you.
We have another caller on the air, another Jessica. Hey, Jessica, if you could briefly tell us what you'd like to say.
Good day. This is so exciting. I was blessed probably about 20 years ago. I had met Paul, who ended up becoming the caretaker of Payne Hollow and was so lucky to get to go visit. It is quite a walk to get down there. So there's no phones or anything, and my friend and I decided we were going to go visit Paul one evening. So we drove out there, and we're hiking down. It's getting dark, and you arrive, and you're like, hello. And Paul greeted us and was happy to see us. And this huge thunderstorm came on, and, I mean, it was scary. We were practically hiding under the table, which was kind of, like, built into the side of the house, or the hillside, because the house kind of sets back in there. But it is a magical place.
Thank you, Jessica. What a wonderful memory.
I'm glad that Jessica brought up Paul Hassfurter. Paul did inherit the land and the home from Harlan when he passed away in 1988. And Paul has been a wonderful steward of that property until a new group that I helped found called Payne Hollow on the Ohio recently purchased the property and is working on the restoration of both the structures and the surrounding landscape right now. But it is a magical place, a place out of time, and certainly a place that it's our hope to be able to preserve for many generations past us.
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned, thank you again, Jessica, our caller. We appreciate you. As I mentioned, there's this exhibit that's going to open at the Beringer Crawford Museum. It opens April 13th. It runs through August 3rd. What about the Hubbards do you think continues to resonate so much with people today?
I think the Hubbards only continue to be more relevant, especially in this era of climate change, this era of uncertainty politically. The Hubbards are offering us maybe not a blueprint we can fully adapt, but are offering us pieces of a way to disconnect from a system that maybe we've grown disenchanted with. They are offering us an alternative way of viewing the world and an alternative way of living within this world. And I think that certainly the ideas of self-sufficiency and the ideas of trying to do no harm are so important for all of us to engage in right now.
Well, I've been talking with author Jessica Whitehead. Her book, Driftwood, The Life of Harlan Hubbard, is the inspiration for an exhibit coming to the Beringer Crawford Museum. You can find more information about the exhibit on our website, wvxu.org. Jessica, thank you for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.